Welcome to the deep dive. Imagine sitting across from your boss, and he just looks you dead in the eye and hands you an assignment that is mathematically guaranteed to get you killed.
Right, the ultimate trap.
Exactly. Like, if you blindly accept it, you fail. But if you look them in the eye and refuse, you might just get promoted to saving the world.
Yeah, which is a wild concept.
It totally is. And today, we have this stack of sources, basically a collection of interconnected fictional logs that completely upends everything you think you know about heroes, monsters, and, well, survival.
It really flips the whole genre on its head.
Our mission today is to unpack how this specific character-driven narrative masterfully subverts all those tired high fantasy tropes, starting with how a hero is actually chosen when the world is actively trying to eat them.
Yeah, and to give you the lay of the land before we jump in, we are following a core cast of deeply flawed, incredibly pragmatic characters. You have Lady Hannah, who is this explorer from House November.
And just to clarify for everyone, in this lore, the houses aren't just like royal families, right? They're almost like sociopolitical guilds.
Exactly, yeah. So House November is very practical, working class, super grounded in reality. Then you have Lord Thomas, who is the brilliant but highly unorthodox Lord Explorer leading her order, the Golden Hawks.
Right.
Following them is Minstrel Sam, this elderly brandy-drinking bard who provides basically real-time cynical commentary on everything.
He's the best.
He really is. And contrasting Hannah, we have Sir Tristan, a fey knight of House April. Now, House April is bound by ancient traditional oaths, so he's a bit rigid, very detached from the dirt and grit of everyday
Oh,
humanity.
and we definitely cannot forget the Night Steeds.
Right. In this universe, they are not just riding animals. They are highly intelligent, bonded equine partners.
Okay, let's unpack this because jumping into these logs feels exactly like reading someone's highly detailed, slightly chaotic D&D campaign diary.
All 100%.
You are immediately thrown into the deep end of the lore without a life jacket. It's a world that operates on this level of organized absurdity. So how do we even ground ourselves in an environment that is this complex right out of the gate?
Well, the most effective way to ground ourselves is to look at the inciting incident. Because in this universe, understanding the mechanics of how a hero is dispatched on a quest tells us exactly what kind of lethal, chaotic environment they have to operate in.
Which takes us to Lord Thomas's office.
Right. And the physical space alone does a lot of heavy lifting for the world building.
It really does. I mean, this office is an absolute disaster zone. It's not some pristine fantasy war room with a glowing table.
No, not at all.
It's just rows of wooden crates, weird statues, ancient scrolls spilling off desks, and like maps of completely uncharted lands pinned to every available surface.
Then Hannah walks into this mess, and Thomas, without even bothering to look up from his paperwork, offers her a brutal solo mission.
Just totally casually.
Exactly. He tells her she needs to go quell an uprising of giant blue head-shrinking trolls all by herself.
And you have to pay attention to the background characters here,
Right.
because Minstrel Sam is literally napping in the corner under a blanket made of old maps.
I love that detail.
He wakes up and, completely deadpan, suggests she is going to need at least two wagons of beer to survive an encounter with head-shrinking trolls.
Right, which he then mathematically calculates and downgrades to a single bottle of brandy as a trade good.
It's so funny. It establishes this baseline of casual terror. The characters are so used to suicidal odds that they're just bargaining over the alcohol budget.
Yeah, but Hannah doesn't just blindly accept the quest like a good little fantasy knight. She pushes back, she folds her arms, digs her heels in, and demands more intel.
She wants logistics.
Exactly. Numbers, terrain, all of it. And that is exactly when Thomas drops the act. He smiles, the tension just evaporates, and he reveals there are no blue trolls. It was entirely a psychological test. He then hands her the real mission, which is a desperate plea from the newly founded, apparently very impoverished land of Greedle.
Right. Princess Griselda the Bountiful is begging the Golden Hawks to rescue her abducted royal groom, Prince Feasel.
And they can't even afford a ransom. Thomas jokes that Humperdinck would be a worse name, and Sam is immediately in the corner workshopping terrible rhymes, just muttering about Feasel the Weasel.
What's fascinating here is the psychology of Thomas's leadership style. At first glance, it reads as incredibly manipulative, right?
Oh, totally.
But look at the mechanics of survival in this world. Thomas is deliberately testing Hannah's critical thinking. He needs to see the structural integrity of her stubbornness.
Will she question a suicidal order from a superior?
Exactly. Because in an environment where monsters are real and the maps are incomplete, Blind obedience doesn't make you a hero. It makes you a casualty.
It totally reminds me of a tech CEO giving a new hire a fake, utterly impossible coding project just to see if they have the guts to look their boss in the eye and say, this is a terrible idea and it's going to crash the servers.
Yes. It sounds like a toxic management style, honestly. Like, think about the last time a superior gave you a task just to test your limits. In a modern office, that's grounds for an HR complaint.
Yeah, a massive red flag.
But in a world where you might be eaten by an unknown biological entity on a Tuesday, is this kind of intense psychological stress test actually an essential mechanism for wilderness survival?
The text strongly argues that it is. Thomas needs a critical thinker because the real mission isn't just a straightforward combat drop. It's a highly delicate diplomatic crisis wrapped in a rescue mission.
They go from the threat of life and death troll combat to Prince Fiesel of Greedle.
Right. The narrative takes the majesty of the quote-unquote call to adventure and completely deflates it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This mental test of leadership immediately gives way to a massive logistical and ego test, because now this team has to actually get to Greedle.
Yeah, rescuing broke royalty means they need specialized transportation, mounts that can handle both the physical terrain and the incredibly delicate political terrain.
Which leads us to the most bizarre recruitment scene in the entire text. They go to the ranch of Countess Agatha Redmayne.
I am absolutely obsessed with Redmayne.
Right. She's a recently titled countess, but the author introduces her sitting on her porch in blue jeans and a t-shirt, wielding a ballpoint pen, just doing paperwork.
It's such a jarring, anachronistic image in a fantasy setting.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then Sir Tristan arrives to deliver some guild records, riding his white war horse, Sohate. And Sohate is the absolute epitome of the traditional fantasy steed.
Oh, he is an equine drill sergeant. He runs battle drills in his downtime. Right. He physically corrects the posture of the younger foals in the paddock.
Sohate represents the mechanical ideal of House April, right? Mm-hmm. Rigid, disciplined, martial.
Exactly. But Hannah belongs to House November. And her options at this ranch are severely limited. In fact, the only available knight steed for her is Princess Peach Blossom Marigold Honeydew.
Peaches.
Yes, Peaches. Who is currently lounging under an oversized pink and white lace parasol.
And wearing a silver tiara.
With silk flowers physically woven into her mane and gold filigree hoof art.
And she literally carries her own handbag. An actual handbag containing an ivory inlaid hairbrush. When Suhei tries to show off his crisp battle maneuvers, Peaches just watches him and fake yawns.
The juxtaposition is deeply comedic, but look at the underlying mechanics of what Redmayne is doing here. Redmayne specifically points out that Peaches is uniquely suited for dealing with royalty.
Because she already acts like one.
Right. She understands the complex social algorithms of a royal court. She demands that Hannah brush her hair and address her with proper titles before she will even entertain the idea of going on this mission.
It's basically a labor negotiation.
It really is. They have to strike this ridiculous binding compromise. Hannah agrees to strictly call her Princess or Marigold.
And Peaches agrees to pack away her tiara into her handbag, but only if Hannah promises to replace the silk flowers in her mane with fresh ones gathered from the side of the road every single day.
And Peaches actually seals this contract with a formal royal bow.
But, I mean, taking a diva horse into a combat zone, it feels like bringing a designer handbag to a mud run. Is this just a massive tactical liability? Or is Redmayne secretly a genius for recognizing that Hannah needs a diplomat, not a tank?
I think Redmayne is absolutely playing three-dimensional chess here. The mission requires them to interface with the bountiful family of Greedle. If you arrive on a terrifying warhorse like Sohate, you intimidate an already insecure royal family.
That makes a lot of sense.
You arrive on Peaches and you speak their language. Mm-hmm. But the author wants you to doubt this choice. You are supposed to view Peaches as dead weight, which perfectly aligns you with Tristan's perspective.
Yeah, Tristan decides to volunteer for this mission right there at the ranch. He claims it's to provide martial support for Hannah, but he openly admits he is just desperate to escape his stultifying peacetime court duties.
He hates the recitals, the endless social posturing. He just wants to hit something with a sword.
Which prompts Thomas to pull Tristan aside for a very quiet, vaguely threatening talk about not causing trouble for Hannah. Mm-hmm. He establishes the chain of command real quick.
And of course, Minstrel Sam announces he's coming too, purely because he smells a good story. He specifically ditches a rookie bard named Byron Songshadow just to secure his spot on the team.
So the party is assembled, but the safety of these comedic preparations is about to evaporate. because as they actually hit the road, the narrative shifts from the sociopolitical maneuvering of the city to the harsh, unforgiving realities of the wild.
The tone shift gives you absolute whiplash.
It really does. They are setting up camp at dusk, right outside this menacing ancient forest, and the tall grass they are camping in is hiding something deeply unsettling.
They start finding skulls. Dozens of antelope and deer skulls hidden in the brush.
But the terror isn't just in finding skulls. It's in the forensic ecology that Hannah observes. These bones do not have the puncture wounds or care marks associated with standard predators like wolves or big cats.
Right, they bear systematic, unnatural chisel marks. The bone has been mechanically sheared.
Which is terrifying.
It is. And even more alarming, there are absolutely no predator tracks in the mud around the kills. The only tracks they find are old troll prints hovering right at the edge of the tree line.
So the trolls are apex monsters, and yet they are refusing to cross out of the woods into the open grass.
Exactly. Whatever is in the grass scares the trolls.
That detail is so creepy. And the horses react to this mass grave exactly how you'd expect based on their personalities. Peaches delicately uses her hooves to arrange a pile of bones into a Valentine's heart.
While Sohat, ever the macho warhorse, immediately vandalizes it by arranging more bones into an arrow piercing her heart.
It's a brief moment of levity, but it serves to heighten the psychological weight of what comes next. Because Sam gathers these skulls, packs the cavities with dirt so they resemble white stones, and builds an ossuary fire pit to cook his famous five-bell chili.
The world building and the recipe alone is great. 5 dried peppers, beans, sausage, cheese, a secret brownish square, and secret green leaves.
A culinary mystery wrapped in a murder mystery. But while they are eating this chili over a fire pit made of sheared deer skulls, Hannah and Tristan have this incredibly quiet, stripped-down conversation.
The defenses are completely dropping.
Tristan is complaining about the shallow vanity of the recent royal gala, talking about how empty and performative the nobility is. And Hannah gets very quiet and reveals that she was actually at that gala.
Yeah, but she left early because she felt entirely inadequate. She didn't feel like she belonged among the elite.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the physical environment is perfectly mirroring their internal psychology. They are sitting in a trackless killing field, completely physically exposed, and their emotional armor is being stripped away just as fast.
Hannah is admitting to profound imposter syndrome, a vulnerability she usually hides behind her pragmatism.
And Tristan is forced to realize that his careless, sweeping judgments about court life just deeply wounded a woman he actually respects.
I have to push back on Tristan a bit here, though. He has this highly romanticized view of his own knightly duty. He thinks he's above the petty court politics.
Yeah.
But isn't Tristan just as guilty of running away as Hannah is? She ran from the gala because she felt emotionally inadequate. He's running into the wilderness because he's bored and lacks the patience for diplomacy.
That is a really good point. Who is actually braver here? The one who knows they are terrified and goes into the wild anyway, or the one using a combat zone as a vacation from social anxiety?
Well, you could argue that Tristan is just seeking adrenaline, but let's look at the mechanics of his choice. Tristan isn't running away from fear. He's retreating to an environment where the rules make sense to him.
Right. Social politics in House April are ambiguous and exhausting.
Exactly. A sword fight is binary. You win or you lose. He's choosing a battlefield he thinks he can control. But the brilliance of this narrative is that the wilderness they are currently sitting in does not play by traditional combat rules.
No, it does not. The vulnerability they are sharing over the campfire is about to be violently shattered. It happens so fast.
The ground just starts to vibrate.
Suddenly there is a massive, deafening roar, and a wave of shadow comes pouring out of the darkness straight toward their camp. It's a massive stampede of antelope running blind with terror.
And Tristan immediately defaults to his training. He tries to pull Hannah onto Sohat so they can outrun the herd or force the stampede to break around the warhorse.
He applies a standard House April tactical response to an overwhelming physical threat.
But Peaches.
Oh man, Peaches.
This is the moment that completely reframes her character. The diva horse, the one who demanded fresh silk flowers and carries a hairbrush, completely subverts her own vanity.
She doesn't run.
No. She drops to her knees and actively tries to roll onto her back to physically shield Hannah from the stampede.
She is literally using her own body mass to act as a flesh and bone boulder to protect her rider.
She's willing to be trampled to death out of pure loyalty. Hannah actually has to fight the horse off just to keep them both from being crushed.
This raises an important question about how the narrative weaponizes absurdity to create genuine terror. You spent the last few chapters judging Peaches by her vanity.
Yeah, but her defining trait isn't vanity, it's an irrational, self-sacrificing devotion. The mechanics of a horse trying to pin you to the ground to save you is horrific because it's a terrifying misapplication of love.
You are suddenly fearing for the life of the punchline.
Exactly. And while they are surviving the stampede, we finally see what is causing it.
A blur leaps up from the tall grass and rips out an antelope's throat midair. You hear the sickening snap of limbs as the animal hits the ground.
And then the predator stands up.
And it is only 2 feet tall. It's covered in pink fur. It has long, flappy ears and glowing red eyes.
It is a tiny, blood-soaked, bunny-like creature. This is the apex predator of the plains. This is the thing that terrifies the trolls.
It sounds like a joke, right? I mean, it's basically the killer rabbit from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It really is.
But think about real-world deceptive predators. Look at the wolverine. It's a relatively small, unassuming animal, but it will drive a grizzly bear off a fresh kill because it is pure, concentrated aggression and mechanical leverage.
Right.
So how does an auto make a pink bunny genuinely terrifying? By building an ecology that supports it. This creature completely pulls the rug out from under the classic dragon fight.
Exactly. The world building earned this reveal. Think back to the forensic evidence at the campfire.
The absolute lack of tracks.
Yes, it's because the creature is incredibly light and navigates by leaping massive distances. And the weird chisel marks on the bone, those are overgrown, rodent-like incisors designed to shear through dense material.
Wow, yeah.
It uses the tall grass for total camouflage, and its leg strength is enough to snap the limbs of an antelope. Biomechanically, it is perfectly evolved for this exact environment. A giant dragon would starve here. This tiny fluff ball dominates.
And then comes the cliffhanger that completely reframes the entire mission. The pink bunny monster stands over its fresh kill, looks directly through the darkness at their camp, and screams in this massive, guttural, completely unnatural voice.
Anna.
It fundamentally changes the genre from fantasy adventure to psychological horror in a single sentence.
It really does.
So what does this all mean? If we look at everything we've unpacked in these logs today, it proves that in this specific world, appearances are a lethal trap. Everything is a deliberate misdirection.
Absolutely.
Thomas's cruel, toxic troll test was actually a vital lesson in critical thinking and insubordination. A vanity-obsessed horse with a designer handbag turned out to be a fearless, self-sacrificing human shield.
And a cute pink bunny is a throat-ripping apex predator, perfectly evolved to hunt in tall grass.
It really makes you reflect on your own daily reality.
Yeah.
How often do you misjudge the peaches or the pink bunnies in your life?
We write people off because their methods look silly, or we trust systems because they look traditionally strong like Suhait. But the truth beneath the surface is always vastly more complicated.
It is a masterclass in subverting expectations through rigorous world building. But it leaves us with one lingering, deeply chilling mystery to mull over.
Yeah, we spent all this time analyzing the monster's biology and biomechanics, but think about its voice.
Why did a trackless, bloodthirsty beast in the middle of an uncharted wilderness know Hannah's name?
What dark, unwritten secrets are hidden in her past that we haven't seen yet? Or has the reputation of the Golden Hawk spread so far into the wild that even the monsters are waiting for them to arrive?
That is something you'll have to explore on your own. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.